Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, for the 26th, that's yes, 26 months in a row, the Reserve Bank has left Australian interest rates on hold at a record low of 1.5%, and its board met today, with the next increase apparently somewhere off in the never-never, or at least maybe the next decade. It's a different story in other parts of the world where interest rates have been rising. And our regular economics commentator, Roger Montgomery, Chief Investment Officer from the Montgomery Fund, is with us tonight to take a look at how that's been affecting share prices around the world. Roger, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Great to be with you again, Phil.
Yes, very good to be. Well, let's start with the domestic scene. No surprises, perhaps, that interest rates have been left on hold. I don't know what your view of it was. Why is what's happening here different to what's happening with regards to interest rates elsewhere in the world?
Well, let me say this at the outset. I'm no good at predicting interest rates. I have no idea when interest rates are going to go up or down, but we do know that globally they're heading higher, and that has consequences, real consequences. So we need to sort of take, before we comment on the implications of higher rates, and to put this in context, back in June 2016, the US 10-year Treasury rates were sitting at about 1.36%. Mm-hmm. That was the lowest they'd been since the 1700s, and I don't think anybody cared what they were before that. And now they're up at around 3.2%. So they've basically doubled.
You know, when they say things like that, Roger, since the 1700s, the economic system was very different.
Yeah, that's why I said no one really needs to go back any further than that, do they? I mean, really?
Yeah. But those it just means that you're kind of meaningless, aren't they?
Well, because they are, but it just means that all the way back to then, there hasn't been a time, even during the Great Depression, that rates were lower than where they were in 2016. Right. So they've since climbed. That's had consequences. But before I talk about what those consequences are, and they have very real consequences for consumption, they have consequences for asset values. So what I want to do first is just take a step back and just explain why interest rates are so important, why people talk about them so much.
Yep.
Fundamentally, if I gave you the choice between $10 today and $10 in 10 years' time, what would you choose?
Well, I'd take the $10 today.
Of course you would. Any rational person would.
I can invest it with the Montgomery.
You could invest it. That's right. But I might not be around to give you the $10 in 10 years' time. There's so many risks that arise when you think about earning that $10 in 10 years' time. My next question to you is, what is that $10? If I gave you a choice of an amount of money today or $10 in the future that were the same value, what would that number be today? So what is, in other words, you know you're going to earn $10 in 10 years. Mm-hmm. What would you pay for it today for that $10?
Well, so I'd pay as little as possible.
You pay as little as possible because that would give you the best return on your money.
That's right.
Right? And so the higher interest rates are, the lower the amount you would pay today for that future $10. So if I used a 15% interest rate, so you decided I want to get a minimum, Rog, I think it's so risky you paying me $10 in 10 years' time. I think that's incredibly risky. I want a 15% return. Well, that makes that future $10 worth $5 today because, sorry, it actually makes it $2.50. So that $2, so you get $2.50 today and then that doubles in 5 years at 15% to $5 and then it doubles again to $10 in another 5 years after that. So at 15%, $10 in 10 years' time is the same as $2.50 today. Now, if I lower the interest rate, if I bring that interest rate down, then what I find is that the value goes up. It goes up a lot more. In fact, at 7%, at 7% interest rate, so I've lowered the interest rate now from 15% to 7%, then what actually happens is that $2.50 today, it's now $5. The $10 in the future is worth $5 today. So what's actually happened is as I lower interest rates, the value goes up today. So what's any asset worth? What's a property, a building worth? What's a business worth? What is any asset worth? It's worth the discounted value of its future cash flows. So when we buy shares, we're buying pieces of businesses that generate cash and we assume that like a bond, they're going to pay that cash to us in the future. And so we try and work out, I mean, the difficulty in the stock market, of course, is it's not guaranteed. We don't know what those cash flows are going to be. So we've got to try and estimate those. But given those, we then have to work out what they're worth today. Now, think about it this way. Interest rates act like gravity does on Earth. So to financial assets or to any asset, the interest rate affects us. It affects those assets the same way gravity affects us. As interest rates go up, the gravitational effect gets stronger. Prices, valuations rather, come down. Now, that's the fundamental valuation question. The price question, why do prices come down when interest rates go up? Well, think about it. That's because when interest rates go up, putting your money in the bank starts to look more attractive. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to take the risky bet. You want to take your money out of the risky things and put it into cash because it's earning a better rate. And that's what's happening around the world at the moment. So now that you have that sort of 101 interest rate lesson and how it affects asset values, think about this. Since the global financial crisis, central banks around the world have been buying the bonds that were issued by their various governments. Mm-hmm. And so typically they were buying US Treasury bonds. That's the biggest one. And so they became the biggest buyer of Treasury bonds on the planet and in history. They've never bought that many bonds before. And consequently, their buying of US Treasury bonds pushed the price of the bond up, which pushes the interest rate down. Just like if you invest in a terrace house, if you pay too much for it, guess what? The yield you're going to get from the rent's going to be very low.
Just to explain to people, a treasury bond is really just an agreement that the government will pay you some money in the future.
The government's borrowing money from you. You're lending it to the government.
You give them money and the government says, in the future, I'll pay you that
well,
amount.
In Australia, the bonds pay every 6 months and they pay you twice a year and they'll pay you an agreed coupon. And the price fluctuates based on what people think interest rates might do in the future. So what we're seeing now
is... Does the government have a limitless number of bonds for sale?
No, they can print as many as they can offer as many as they want. They can borrow as much as they like. I mean, eventually the currency is going to have an effect. People are going to say this country can't afford to pay its debt and its currency is going to fall. But let's get back to central banks for a minute. So since the GFC, the central banks, particularly the Fed, the US central bank, and the Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank, they were buying US Treasury bonds. So the borrowings, they were lending money to the government. Effectively what they were doing, but is by buying the bonds, though, in the secondary market rather than the primary market, they were paying cash for those bonds, putting cash into the financial system.
Why were they doing that? Why do they?
Because,
is that because they can't find
any? Because they dropped interest rates to zero and nobody spent any money. Nobody did anything, and there was a fear that we'd head into a depression after the GFC. And so they thought this is one of the biggest financial experiments of all time, if not the biggest. They decided to buy the bonds, which then not only brings so short-term interest rates are already at zero. Mm-hmm. By buying the bonds, they lower the long-term interest rates, which then changes investment decisions that everyone makes. Because if your interest rate in the short term and the long term are the same, or the return that you can make are the same, you'll go out. The theory was you'll go out and invest today. And that's what happened. People use that money to buy assets. They bought shares, they bought stamps, they bought collectible cars, they bought bonds. That's what they did. And they pushed the prices of these assets up and they pushed the yields of those assets down. But then something happened. In 2017, the US Federal Reserve slowed its buying of bonds. So they went from quantitative easing to quantitative tapering. And now this year they've entered what's called quantitative tightening. So they're not buying those bonds anymore. So what happens when you take out the biggest buyer of bonds in the world? They're not buying anymore. But at the same time, you've got Donald Trump and the US government issuing new bonds because they've got a massive fiscal deficit, right? They're spending money.
So if no one's buying them, what's happening?
Well, the price of the bonds
goes down.
And what happens to interest rates? They go up. The reverse, right? Just like if you buy a terrace house here in Ultimo, you pay a very low price, you're going to get a better yield. And so yields start going up on US Treasury bonds. Now, this is the complication. This is what I'm worried about for next year.
That makes them more valuable again.
Well, it makes the bond price go up. Bond price goes down, but the yield goes up. If you've already paid a high price for the bond and the price goes down, well, you lose capital.
Correct.
The bond price goes down, you're losing money. Mm. So that's what's going on in the treasury bond market at the moment. So that's the official government bond market or sovereign bond market. But here's the thing, because over the last few years, interest rates on IOUs from the US government were so low, in other words, you know, bond rates were so low, people moved out the risk curve. So what they did is they started investing in riskier bonds because they could get a better interest rate.
Issued by what, like who?
By companies. Corporate bonds.
What we used to call debentures.
Well, yeah. So we don't have much of a corporate bond market in Australia that's domestically funded. Hmm. Most of it's overseas funded. But in the US, what we've seen is a boom in bonds being issued by companies. And in fact, the quality of those companies, as people looked for higher yields, they were willing to invest in lower and lower quality businesses. And they were willing to put fewer and fewer requirements on those companies to pay that money back. So they were called covenant light bonds or no covenant bonds. And so what actually happened now is we've got something like 47% of all US corporate bonds at triple B ratings, which is the lowest investment grade. And that's a record number, 47%.
Like basically rubbish.
Well, I think some of these companies are going to be they're going to have their ratings downgraded next year. And we'll talk about that in just a sec. And then we've also got a record amount of triple C rated, which is the old junk bonds. Mm. So they now call them high yield bonds. Huh. They don't call them junk bonds anymore. And so we've now got a record $490 billion US dollars of triple C rated junk bond debt due to be refinanced next year. Well, guess what? The problem is now that the Treasury bond rates are going back up, which is what we just talked about a few minutes ago, people are saying, you know what, those government bond rates, I can lend my money to the US government and get a good rate now. I don't want to lend my money to US corporates anymore. I'm going to take my money out of those. I'm going to sell those bonds and buy the Treasury bonds because they give me a better yield. What happens to the price of the Treasury bonds? The corporate bonds, they go down and they go down faster because they're less liquid.
Makes the company worse.
The rate goes up. The interest rate that the company has to pay when they refinance goes up. They've got a lot of debt, so they get downgraded by the ratings houses. And so next year, all this is going to happen. We're going to have triple B-rated companies being downgraded. That's going to really put the cat amongst the pigeons or the fox in the hen house. And then we've got all these triple C-rated companies who are going to have to refinance their debt, and their interest rates are going to be a lot higher, and the appetite is going to be diminished because a lot of people are saying, I don't want to lend money to those companies anymore. I want to put my money with the US government because the rate is starting to look more attractive. Now, if this has gone over everyone's head, don't worry. It just means that next year there's probably going to be a lot more volatility, and there's going to be a lot more surprises with companies unable to pay their interest. In fact,
if a company can't pay their interest,
yep.
In other words, meet their bond redemptions, what do they do?
Well, they either have to refinance, so they have to borrow more, so they basically take out a new credit card to pay off the old credit card, and they extend their terms.
I suppose the worst result is they go bust. Do they?
The worst result is they go bust, and some will. I've no doubt some will. The other thing that can happen is they can raise equity capital. So they might go back to their shareholders and they might say, look, we need to raise capital to pay down the debt. The only problem is the return on equity when a company raises equity capital to pay down debt, the return on that equity is just the interest rate on the debt. That's all it is, and it's once off. So, you know, it can really damage a company's future prospects or its future returns. If it had very high rates of return on equity, then it raises, and it has a lot more debt, it raises money to pay down that debt. It can survive because it doesn't suddenly need to pay that debt and sack everybody or go bust. But I think what's going to happen next year is we're going to find that there's going to be a lot more volatility as a consequence of this massive tidal change in the appetite for lending money to corporates in the United States.
What does it mean? I mean, I know we don't predict interest rates, but I was just reading today that plenty of people think that interest rates in Australia might go down next year. Plenty of sensible opinion says that.
And my response is it doesn't matter.
Other sensible opinion says it'll go up. They might go above 2%.
But guess what? The story that I've just given you is not going to change, irrespective of what the Reserve Bank of Australia does. And if internationally interest rates are going up, the benchmark US rate is going up, then the cost of funding for Australian banks will also have rising pressure on it. Now, when the bank's cost of funding goes up, then what they have to do is they have to pass some of that on to people who've got mortgages. Which they've already been doing. Yeah. Even though the Reserve Bank, as you pointed out in your introduction, hasn't touched rates for 2 years, 24 months or thereabouts. Raised their mortgage rates. And so it's inconsequential, really, what the Reserve Bank of Australia does. For mortgage holders in Australia, what's really important is what's going on in these international markets.
Hmm. Okay. All right.
Now, that's just one big seismic shift.
Yeah.
The other big seismic shift that's happening is I think what we're seeing is potentially the end of the hockey stick view of, and when I talk about hockey stick, I mean that 45 degree line, that hockey stick view of the indisputable profit growth for technology companies around the world. So up until this year, what we saw was, you know, really just an unquestioning belief in technology's ability to change the world. And from everything, I mean, think about it, 3D printing, they can now 3D print transplantable human organs. They're 3D printing meat burgers made from the cells of plants that taste and look like meat.
So they say.
Yeah, that's right. I haven't tasted one yet. They're 3D printing a whole range of fantastic things for cars and so on. So that's 3D printing. Then there's electric vehicles. Then there's autonomous vehicles, there's artificial intelligence, there's drone technology. There's so much happening all at the same time.
That's what we're being told, you know, is the next thing. That forget autonomous vehicles. They may or may not be here. Well, they will be here in some form or another. Almost everyone that I read tends to say the next big shift in the world, and the way that the internet was a massive shift. I mean, you and I, you know, we can remember when there was no internet. Lots of people would remember easily when there was no internet. The internet has completely changed the world.
Yes.
The next big thing most people seem to suggest is AI, this notion of machine, that is machine intelligence, that this will really change things. That is, we won't be using machines to help us. The machines will do the thinking for us.
Well, that's that event horizon where the machines take over and start developing their own.
It's a very, very big seismic shift. Yeah. That is that they will, in other words, the machines will be running things, not in a way that a computer runs things now. Machines will be making independent decisions about things.
That's a scary thought.
Well, it is and it isn't, in a way.
well, people did put their names last year to a document that said, you know, we need to be very careful about releasing AI because it'll be the humankind's greatest achievement its last.
But the number of people working on this is...
Well, they're always working on it, right? Everest is there, right? So, yeah, you know, it's amazing how many... What happened?
So it will happen.
People said, hey, 3D printing going to be great. What did people start doing when they got a 3D printer? They printed plastic guns so that they could smuggle them through customs. You know, you get this great technology that has so many benefits and people use it for...
You'd have to say that 3D printing has been ultimately a much greater benefit than has been a cost. In the same way, for example, that the motor car has. I mean, the motor car's come at a cost.
Well, that's what I want to talk about, though. It's not that it won't change the world. I'm not going to deny that. Mm. It will change the world. But will everybody who's invested in it make money from it? And history suggests otherwise.
Over to you.
Yeah. So what's interesting is I think a lot of investors make the mistake of getting excited about how the technology is going to benefit humankind and immediately believe that by investing in it, you're also going to do well. But what history shows is actually it's often the consumer that wins as a consequence of new technology being developed. And so if you look at the motor vehicle, for example, you know, this is an interesting one. And I think we might have talked about this the last time I was here, but we spent a bit more time talking about cars and I'm not going to do that tonight. But you know, Carl Benz in the late 1800s drove the first horseless carriage and his wife actually took it to another town. And that was what really got, you know, people talking. Mm. That was, hey, this car thing, you could do more than just parade around the park with it. You could actually do stuff. You can go shopping with it in another town.
Come back on the same day.
And so you would have thought, hey, this is going to change the world. This is so exciting. I'm going to buy car manufacturers. Well, in the United States, they've had something like 1,500 car manufacturers since then. Yet there's only one that exists today that is profitable and wasn't bailed out by the government during the GFC, and that's Ford. The rest of them have all been broke at one stage or another, or gone completely. And it's the same with commercial flight. It's the same with the development of the television. There's a lot of technology that changed the course of human history, but it wasn't good for shareholders. A lot of shareholders blew up their money. And so I think there's a very real prospect that people have attributed the change, or they've looked at the change that the technology companies in the world today will make for us, and they've said, you know what, you could pay any price for this company and it's going to do great. And I'll give you an example. Tesla's a classic, because if you compare the price of the company, the car manufacturers, to the number of the cars they actually deliver, well, Ford is sitting on about $5,600 per car delivered, and they delivered 6.6 million cars last year. Tesla only delivered 126,000 cars. It's trading on about $394,000 per car delivered.
Yeah, look, I think everyone thinks that electric cars are coming, but they're not coming from Tesla. They'll be coming from Mitsubishi or
Well, they'll be coming from Kia, Volvo from Kia, or Mercedes-Benz or, and whoever.
From the Koreans or wherever. Yeah.
Tesla has to increase its production from 126,000 cars to 1.7 million cars, and then it will be on the same market multiple as Mercedes-Benz is today, and you've made no money on the shares in the meantime.
Doesn't matter. I don't know. I'm just musing here in a way, but I mean, do we – there's lots of – there is always technology in the world and always different technology, but as you say, not some of it doesn't necessarily make any money. I was reading a piece about the 5G mobile network, for example, which Telstra is investing, you know, and not only Telstra, I mean, people around the world are investing huge amounts of money in. Almost everyone thinks it won't actually make any difference to anyone's life, particularly. Well, at least not yet, and maybe not ever. But it has to be, because it's faster, it will be done.
Yeah.
But
that's the concern you raised earlier with AI, right?
Yeah. Because it's faster, it will be done. It's not necessarily, though, going to make anybody any money.
No. As an investor, I worry about that. You know, I think of companies like Uber and Netflix. You know, there'll be a raft of people listening.
Well, they don't make money.
They make bigger losses. They've just.
I don't know about Netflix. Netflix make a loss?
No, yes, it does. It's just recorded its biggest quarterly loss.
I know Uber makes a loss.
So the problem with TV is streaming has really fragmented audiences now, and so the big television production houses of the past have really been disrupted by the likes of Netflix and Amazon, who are using, you know, either the benevolence of shareholders or their other businesses, in the case of Amazon, to fund the production of, you know, fantastic content, making great production. People get really excited about it, but people want it faster and they want to pay less for it. So what's happening is the entire industry has to run faster, has to give up all their affiliate fees and go direct to the consumer and build a direct-to-consumer model, start charging some sort of subscription rate. But consumers don't want to pay a lot for it. They don't realise that they were paying a fortune for their content in the past, because it was all behind the studios through affiliate fees and the like and the distribution houses. But now what's happening is that's all been disrupted. The problem is the companies doing the disrupting aren't making any money.
What about Facebook? Is that making money?
Facebook does make money. Yes, it does. All of its assets do, but it makes a huge amount of money.
Yeah, I know this.
And so does Google.
I know this was a debate we were having some years ago, but I suspect things have moved on since we're having the debate about the arrival of the internet and, say, for example, advertising in the internet. Which everyone knew, unveiled myriad possibilities. The trouble is, no one could actually work out how to make any money out of this.
Well, now what's happening, the way they're making money is from advertisers. So what's happened is advertisers have said, do you know what, if I go on TV and put an ad on TV or put an ad on radio, there's this amorphous group of people listening, but I can't target Philip Clark.
That's what Facebook is.
Whereas Facebook can Facebook can get it down to a group of 9 people that you want to specifically target. You know, that's real targeted advertising. So now, I'm not sure.
This afternoon, for example.
Yes.
I'm not kidding. This is how bad it is at the moment.
Right.
Not this afternoon. This morning, I needed my office chair at home broke. Yep. I looked up an office chair.
Yes.
And I identified one that I thought looked okay.
Yes.
every single time I've used the internet from then on today.
Office chair ads.
Even I'm reading the New York Times. In the middle of the body of text I'm reading, there's an ad, not just for office chairs, for the office chair that I looked at. Now,
there you go. That's targeted advertising.
That's
stalking.
That's stalking.
Yeah, it's targeted advertising. But here's the thing. So everyone got really excited about digital advertising and got really excited about that technology and what it can do. And they're still very excited about it. It's still happening. The problem is there's a narrative shift occurring right now where you've got the Democrats in the United States saying, you know what, we've got a new economic agenda and we may even crack down on social and political influence amongst these big companies. In Europe, they actually decided that that Uber is a taxi company, not a technology company. Mm. And so its drivers have to register, they have to pay licenses, they have to register their vehicles. And that way you've got a level playing field. Airbnb in New York and in Ibiza in Spain, if you've got more than a certain number, I think it's 2 or 3 apartments listed, you can't list them for a very short period of time anymore. In New York, you have to list them for at least 30 days. You know, they have to be rentals for more than 30 days. So that changes the dynamic. Apple was fined. Facebook's under investigation. Google's been fined for favoring its own ads. You know, there's all this antitrust groundswell of antitrust, I guess, feeling towards these companies that's shifting the goalposts. And so the analysts around the world and the investors around the world who thought these companies are going to change the world forever and their profits are going to rise on 45-degree lines forever, that's changing. That's not the case.
That's true, but so I don't know where we left with that, though. I mean, even acknowledging, acknowledging what you say is
right. It's exciting for investors. It's really good for investors
because where does that leave investors? Well, because after all, the trajectory is not going to change.
Well, no, it's not. It's still going to be. So
you're still going to get the development of exciting new technology.
Correct, but you know, Alibaba's now down 29%. Facebook is off almost 40%. Amazon's down 26%. Apple and Google down 20%. Twitter's off 32%. Netflix is down.
But 36%. They went up so fast, that's all.
But these are crashes in anyone's language. The 87 crash was, you know, 50 or 60%. So, you know, these are big share price falls, and that's why I'm getting excited now. And I was warning everyone last year about how expensive these things were, and now it starts to look like the combination of volatility that we're going to have next year, along with a shift in expectations about the growth prospects for these companies. You know, Phil, markets overreact on the upside, they overreact on the downside.
That's right.
And all I'm saying is next year, you and I will be talking about some overreactions on the downside. So what I'm saying is people need to get prepared for some of these great opportunities. People are going to turn off them. They're going to say, oh, they're not the companies I thought they were. They're not going to be able to grow as fast. But share prices will factor in even more than that, even a more dour or dire situation than that. And that'll be the opportunity for us to invest in some of these businesses.
Christmas is upon us.
Yes,
Roger, which means people spend money.
Yeah, they do.
Well, traditionally they do. I don't know. Consumer spending has been down, or retail spending has been down hugely over the last couple of years. People have pointed to low wage growth as a possible reason for that. Where do you see it going?
Yeah, look, I am really concerned because the third largest employer sector in Australia or employment sector is construction. Construction and housing activity has fallen off a cliff. So renovations, additions, high-rise constructions, approvals for high-rise construction, it's fallen dramatically. And what that could potentially mean is less work on for tradies. If that happens, they'll be spending less. We've got Australian households at their most indebted ever. And when you get a combination of less income and record debt, that's really not a good recipe for consumption. That's not a good recipe for retail spending. So we've seen lots of companies come out like Lovisa. We've seen Nick Scali, Harvey Norman, Meijer. All these companies have come out. Super Cheap Auto, the Super Retail Group. They've all come out and said the first quarter of this financial year has been tough. It's tough on the East Coast, and it's probably going to get tougher because that debt's not going to be paid down because such a high proportion of the mortgage debt that was taken out was interest only. About 49% of all loans written, all mortgages written in 2015 were interest only loans. So since then, no one's paid down their debt. The debt's still hanging over their heads. So if the economy slows, if retailers start sacking people or employing them on a part-time basis and they're not earning as much money, that debt hasn't gone away, and so people will spend less. Now, what we saw during the reporting season was we saw AGL come out. AGL said they reported a 22% jump in bad and doubtful debts. We saw companies like the Commonwealth Bank. Matt Comyn came out and said we're expecting arrears to go up, and that was because he knows that because under the APRA guidelines, banks can only write 30% of new mortgages as interest only. That means there's going to be a lot of people over the next couple of years, particularly 2019, 2020, who are going to be migrated onto principal and interest loans. So their repayments are going to go up, even if interest rates don't go up. But guess what? Interest rates have gone up. And so repayments are going up. And that means there's even less money in the kitty to spend on other things.
Sure. Mm.
So I'm really concerned about it. Here's the thing though, a lot of it might be factored into prices now. So we've seen the share prices of a lot of retailers come off a great deal. And so really the next couple of years, you know, you don't want to wait until the sparrows start singing, because if you do, spring's already over, right? You want to be buying these things when they're on their knees and it looks like it's absolutely terrible and it's never going to improve again.
Mm.
And that'll be the time to buy. And I suspect the next 12 or 18 months, we might actually see that. I know it sounds odd that I'm excited about lower prices, but I keep saying to people, you want to buy stocks like you buy groceries. And I'm quoting Benjamin Graham there.
Mm.
You know, when they're cheap, you want to buy more. And so I think the next couple of years, we could be delivered some really great opportunities.
Okay, let's take a few calls. Lucas, hello.
Hi there, Phil. Hi there, Roger.
I'm G'day, Lucas.
Away you go, yeah. Lucas.
Just wanted to ask about oil prices. So we've seen like maybe 6 to 8 weeks of continued crude price decline, and there hasn't been too much volatility in the Australian dollar. And in the city today in Melbourne, I filled up for $1.10, and then I'm maybe 30 kilometres away, and it's $1.50.
Yep.
And I don't understand where this pricing, like this synthetic price cycle comes from.
Yeah, look, it's one the ACCC has constantly looked at and not been
Lucas,
able to
we're
solve.
We're going away for 18 years and we'll be back with an answer, maybe.
It's I'm leaving that one up to the ACCC. I mean, there's an unusual dynamic in the pricing of petrol in Australia, the ACCC has had a look. They've reported that there isn't collusion, and so you know it's kind of inexplicable unless people start actually, you know, all using those apps where they start caring about the price that they pay and going to the cheapest rather than just the most convenient. I don't think it's going to change very much.
It's unhinged from reality, Lucas, and the ACCC don't seem to know the answer either.
Mm.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
I mean, not really much of an answer,
I know, it's not much of an answer. I know, but I have personally spent several years interviewing anybody I could find who would know the answer, and no one knows the answer.
I have an app on my phone. I know I'm probably not supposed to. I think it's free, so yeah. It's a free app.
Which tells me the cheap petrol is.
It actually tells me. It's called Motormouth.
Motormouth.
And it's absolutely fantastic. It gives me a map of where I am, and it shows me with green and red dots where the cheap and expensive petrol.
The ACCC said you should use things like this, actually. Lenny from Blackheath in New South Wales says, Phil, any word on cryptocurrencies?
No.
Idea like bitcoins? We're all over that now, aren't we?
Yeah.
That's all over, isn't it?
Look,
I think
the whole distributed ledger idea, which is what cryptocurrencies are based on, bitcoins based on, you know, I think that's a great idea, you know, decentralized databases.
Mm.
You know, that really would disrupt centralized organizations like banks, for example, or share registries, for example. I think there's merit in that, but working out how to pay people like you and me to run the servers that actually keep the ledgers operating and keep them all accurate, that's what Bitcoin tried to solve, you know, by giving people a coin to pay them for doing this job. But, you know, if they crash, the coins crash and nobody wants the coins, well, people aren't going to maintain the ledger. So what's the incentive to maintain the ledger?
It basically, that's right, it seems to have landed like that, doesn't it? That in the end, paying people and the ease of the system wasn't there. And that's that despite the promises of the distributed ledger being easy, it wasn't easy. And therefore, people have lost interest in it for that reason.
Well, it's great. I mean, in theory, it's great. You know, instead of my...
Uses half the world's electricity to try and find these coins.
Instead of my... Well, the coins were just one way of trying to reward people for maintaining the ledger. And then what happened, of course, it was corrupted and suddenly people started trading the coins. You know, I think we'll see cryptocurrency 2.0 or distributed ledger 2.0, and that will be a something else that's probably got longer legs.
Jeff says, hi, I've got substantial bank shares. I did consider selling some or all at the announcement of the Royal Commission to the banks, but I didn't. The share price in the sector's dropped. I'm now unsure what to do.
Okay.
What do you think?
Yeah, well, I've got some thoughts on that. So in the absence of a recession, Phil, the bank shares are starting to look pretty good. In fact, since early 2015, you're not going to believe this, but since April 2015, they've fallen, all of them have fallen between 25 and 35%. And that's in a market that has gone up about 3.8% in that time. So they've massively underperformed the stock market. And they've been a terrible investment for the last 3 years, or almost coming up to 4 years now, 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And so, in the absence of a recession, if there's no recession, if we don't believe there's going to be a recession the next couple of years in Australia, they actually look pretty cheap. And you've got to remember that in the next 35 years or thereabouts, the population of Australia will double. Now, someone's going to ring up and say, hang on a sec, it's not 35 years, Rog, it's going to be 45 or 50. Yeah, well, they said that last time. Hmm. They said it was going to take longer to get to 25 million, and we got there in far less time than we thought. And so I suspect it'll be 35 years that Australia's population will double. And guess who's going to be writing the most mortgages? It'll be our banks, and they'll be writing a lot more mortgages then than they're writing today. Mm-hmm. Now, inevitably, they go through various cycles, and I think the cycle currently is against them. The wind is against them. Their credit growth is slowing, so they're not writing as many mortgages now, so their mortgage book isn't growing by as much as it was in the past. And it's also true that their net interest margin is coming under pressure because of overseas funding costs going up. That's true too. But that's when the opportunity is. The opportunity is when the wind is against them, share prices have fallen a lot, that's when you start taking an interest. Now, in our funds, what we've done is we've said, okay, we think they look attractive at the moment. There is a possibility that their share prices go down even more. So we want to be in a position to be able to buy more. The four banks are 27% of the ASX 200, and we have about 8 or 9% of our portfolio in the bank. So we're underweight the banks. We think they're cheap, but they could get cheaper. And if there is a recession, you know, our most sort of dire situation would be that Australia has some negative growth. The bank shares would fall further. Mm. We would probably add to that position.
Okay. George, hello.
Hello, yes.
G'day,
hi,
George.
Hi, George.
Hey, just wanted to get your view, Roger, on the recent drop in CSL.
Yep. So CSL share price, look, one of the most outstanding in terms of a quality, you know, we divide up the market into quality bands. CSL yep. is one of the highest quality businesses that's listed in Australia, if not the highest quality. And all that's happened is its share price got ahead of its earnings. Its share price got ahead of its growth in earnings. And the way to think about it is if you actually told CSL that it couldn't grow anymore, it couldn't raise prices, so there was no revenue growth from raising prices, and it couldn't open up any more collection centres or go into new geographies like China, for example, then yes. it would stop growing. Now, that means that's a business that's earning $3 billion or thereabouts, call it $3 billion. For a business that never grew, that kept earning $3 billion a year, what kind of return on your money would you want? You know, I think probably call it 8% or maybe a bit less than that. But if it was 8%, you'd pay $37.5 billion for that business. That's what I'd pay for that asset, $37.5 billion. Yep. When it was at its high, so when it got to over $200 or $225 or whatever it was really expensive. It was trading at over $107 billion. So what was happening is people were willing to buy three of today's CSLs for the growth, for one with growth. And that to me is just extraordinary. You know, that's optimism going crazy. And so all that's happened now is people have wound back their expectations, and those who paid too much probably panicked and got out. And that's why the share price has come off. Now, if it comes off any further, it starts to look really interesting from a value perspective. The growth will be there over the next 10, 15, 20 years. I still think it's an extraordinary business. I still think it's going to do really well. The demand for its products aren't going anywhere. It's investing a lot into research and development, so it'll develop new products. Its share price just got a little bit ahead of itself, and that happens from time to time. And it's really important you don't pay too much, because even if you pay too much for even a very high quality business, you can still lose money.
Hmm. Okay, George.
Okay, thanks for that.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Bye bye. Greg, hello.
Hello. Look, fantastic show, gentlemen. Fantastic show.
Thank you.
I'm not sure where that gentleman lives, but. There's many, many shops along Chapel Street, which is in Melbourne, okay?
Yeah, yep. No, it will.
Yep.
And splattering along Malvern Road, sort of Armadale area, and they're vacant, right? So
yep.
My question is, there appears to be, you know, these shops that are Smiggles and a number of other big companies have just shut and left Chapel Street / Toorak.
Yeah, what you're talking about there is exactly what we've been talking about, and that is that, you know, that retailers are really struggling, not only because the economy, people are spending less and there's record debt, but they're being disrupted by the internet as well.
I wonder if that's right. Like high street retailing, that is shopping on, retailing in shops is under pressure. Doesn't mean necessarily that people are buying less things, though.
You know, it's just curious. We're talking about retail. It's just curious to me the timing of the Lowy family's exit from retail real estate for good. You know, well, maybe not for good, but for now, completely out of it. That's a signal. You know, that's something to think about. Why are they getting out? Do they think it doesn't have the returns that it once did? And maybe that's true. And what the gentleman has just called up, you know, talking about Chapel Street and Armadale and, you know, Toorak and South Yarra and so on, and lots of empty stores, those landlords are discovering probably what the Lowys already knew, and that is it's tougher for retailers to make money from bricks and mortar, and so it's going to be harder to get a return from the real estate as well.
Just briefly before you go, Rog, there's been, of course, a lot of pessimistic forecasts. The media is...
they love it.
They love this.
They love it.
The media have gone bananas about falling house prices the same way they go bananas with rising house prices.
Which we warned about, didn't we?
Exactly. We warned about it. Well, you warned about it, exactly, early this year and last year. Now, so far it doesn't seem to have spilled over into the broader economy. Do you think it will?
Look, I think it has an effect through consumption.
Yeah.
So people don't feel as wealthy.
Therefore, they don't buy a car.
They won't buy a car. They won't spend as much on maybe an overseas holiday. They'll travel domestically.
Yep.
Yes, it's called the wealth effect. It has a positive influence. When people's assets are going up, they feel more emboldened to spend and borrow against those rising assets. And the reverse is also true. When their asset price, their main asset, is going down, especially when they've got negative equity. So especially when the price of the house, or the price they believe they could sell the house for, is less than what they owe on that property, that really gets people recalibrating how much money they're willing to spend. So yes, through consumption, it can have a negative effect on the broader economy.
If you read some of the media in the last few days, though, you'd think the world is ending, which of course it's not. If you look at a graph of where property prices have been,
yes,
the little falls in
rent,
even though large in percentage terms, really haven't even scratched the surface of what the increase has been.
I remember towards about this time last year, or at the start of this year, I remember saying to you, Phil, you know, cash was starting to, on a risk-adjusted basis, cash was looking more attractive than residential real estate. Why? Because cash paid, people said to me, it only pays 2.5%. But hang on a sec, you're willing to go out and borrow money to buy a property to get a rental income that after interest is negative, it's costing you money, and you're saying 2.5% is not enough? So you're willing to buy a property that has a risk of a capital loss and it's giving you negative yield, and cash is starting to look more attractive. And that's when the shift starts to occur. People say, hang on a sec, why am I taking this risk? And unfortunately, what we've seen is about a 70% drop in applications to the Foreign Investor Review Board. So we're seeing less foreign demand for real estate. Yep. This is not just in Australia, this is global. So real estate prices are dropping in London and New York and Toronto and Hong Kong and Auckland and Queenstown. It's all slowing down everywhere because interest rates are going up. There's less demand and costs for existing owners through their mortgages are going up as well. So there might be some forced sales.
Rob, hello.
Hello, Phil and Roger.
G'day, Rob.
Yeah, Roger, look, my question is, like, the Royal Commission with the banks, we've seen exposed a lot of poor corporate behaviour, poor corporate culture with senior executives. Now, I believe, like, banks aren't the only ones with poor corporate ethics.
Mm, sure.
How can the everyday investor discern when they're investing in a company that A, the board is sort of got integrity and the CEOs are, I'm not exactly, ethical.
I get the point you're making. Any thoughts, Rog?
Yeah, we look at track record. Yeah, we do look at track record. We look at we only invest where we think that there's a terrific legal system, regulatory system to ensure that people who behave poorly are going to suffer consequences, that hopefully that's a disincentive enough for them not to behave that way. But the Royal Commission has uncovered, lax lending standards, poor corporate behaviour. You're absolutely right. They've uncovered it.
It's hard for the individual investor to know, though.
But you know what? You can't really regulate against, you can't prevent bad behaviour because by definition, people are going to break the law, right? That whatever the law is, there are people who are going to break it. And so how do you find out those that aren't? Well, what we do is we look for long-run track records. We look for history. We look for where these people have worked before. Mm-hmm. And that's not enough to avoid all of the landmines. So what we do is we build a portfolio. We don't invest in just one company. We have a portfolio. We have a team. And occasionally you get a player benched. But hopefully you've still got a winning team.
Yes, indeed. Bob, hello.
Oh, hello, Phil and Roger.
G'day, Bob.
It's just something I watch a commercial radio TV show in Melbourne each Saturday, and they give out the total auctions for that week.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And what I'm finding hard to believe is the figure they give seems to be well inflated, the clearance rate to what it should be.
Yeah, so what actually happens there, it's interesting, what actually happens is the number of properties when you see the clearance rate on a Monday for the weekend's auctions, that tends to be adjusted afterwards because what actually happens is a lot of properties are pulled and aren't auctioned. If there were no bids registered, they don't put the property to auction. So what you're actually getting is a slightly inflated number because you're only looking at the properties that actually did go to auction.
Because on Wednesday you're going to auction, by Thursday
you're not going to auction now. You know, we'll just pull it and we'll try it again later. Yeah. And so the auction clearance rate's actually probably lower than what's being reported at the moment. Yeah. Now, that housing, that's an element of housing activity. Housing activity is a measure of the transactions, the number of transactions that occur. And because that number is falling off a cliff, it also means that in 10 months' time, there's going to be a lot less renovation and addition activity going on. Typically, what people do is they buy a property and then 10 months later, they renovate it. There's going to be a lot less of that going on. So that's going to affect companies like Bunnings and Metcash, who owns home timber and hardware and so on.
I can see that, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, it just shocks me every week. Like last Saturday, it was nearly 1,100 at auction, 374 sold at auction, and a smaller amount passed in. But the clearance rate was shown as 47%. But if I look at the sold compared to the total, it's only
34%. You're on it. Exactly right. All right, Rog, we'll have to leave it there. But thanks, thanks so much. Been fantastic as always.
Thank you, Phil.
All the best over the Christmas.
Very happy Christmas to you and to everyone.
See you back next year.
Okay.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.